I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Add inflation to the list of economic woes facing American consumers. The Labor Department announced today that wholesale prices rose by 1% in January, more than double the jump that analysts had predicted. The increase comes as the number of homes foreclosed around the country continues to rise. Last month alone, 233,000 homeowners missed at least one mortgage payment. This despite efforts by lenders to modify loan terms. In a moment, we'll look at how tenants are being affected by foreclosures. But first, we turn to Mark Zandi of MoodysEconomy.com. Zandi is testifying before Congress today about these and other economic concerns. We asked him what he's going to tell legislators.
Three things. First, that the economy is likely in a recession. It's contracting, and there's certainly parts of the country that are in recession already. Secondly, that the root problem is the housing mortgage market. As you mentioned, mortgage foreclosures are surging, and that's likely to continue well into this year despite loan modification efforts. And then third, despite policymakers' efforts, good efforts, lower interest rates and a fiscal stimulus package, it's probably not enough, and policymakers are going to have to focus on policies designed to help support the housing and mortgage markets.
Well, going back to your first point that many parts of the country are already in a recession, where are they? What states are already there, and when will the country entirely be in a recession?
California, Arizona, Nevada, Florida, Michigan are in recession. Those states account for one-fourth of the nation's GDP. And then there are 15 other states across the country that are very close and likely to fall into recession in the next few months. They account for another fourth of GDP. And then the big metropolitan areas on the east, northeast coast, Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., are also struggling. And if you total it all up, it's over half the nation's economy, and that's a recession.
And as you said, the root of the problem is the housing market, which is evaporating, and it's resulted in a credit crunch and a credit squeeze. How does this play out? I mean, is credit not available for the average person to start a business or add on to their home?
It's increasingly difficult to get credit, no matter who you are, whether you're a bad credit or a good credit, whether you're a consumer or a business person. The cost of credit has risen. So even if you can get a loan, you're having to pay a lot more for it. This doesn't completely undermine the economy overnight, but over time, it becomes an increasing problem. And as long as we have this credit squeeze crunch, the risks are very high that the economy is going to struggle.
Congress and the president recently passed and signed an economic stimulus package that was supposed to kickstart the economy, you know, get us out of this possible recession, which you say where many parts of the country are now already in. But you're saying we're not going to see any benefits from that anytime soon.
No, because the tax rebate checks, which are the key part of that stimulus package, don't get mailed to us until May and June and July. By then, the economy will have contracted for 3-6 months. So it may push the economy back out of recession into a weak recovery, but that by itself is not going to do the trick. More fundamentally, it doesn't go to the problems in the housing mortgage markets, which we've already, I think, suggested that are at the root of the problem. So I think policymakers need to be thinking about what are they going to do to help out those key markets.
So that's where you see the solutions lie, is looking at the mortgage crisis.
Yeah, most fundamentally. I mean, I do think the administration and Congress have made some good steps in this direction. Even in the stimulus package, there were a few things that helped the housing and mortgage markets. But their baby steps are not enough, and I do think we're coming to the point where we're going to have to put taxpayer money on the line to try to solve this problem.
And as we just reported, January, inflation was more than double than analysts had been expecting, rose by 1%. Do you think that's going to accelerate this slide into recession?
Yeah, that's a real problem. Obviously, it makes life very difficult for all of us. If we have to put more into our gasoline tank, if we have to pay more for a loaf of bread, we've got less to spend on everything else. And, that's a problem. Hopefully, oil prices will come down in the next few weeks, couple months, because if they don't, we're going to be looking at $4 for a gallon of gasoline. Right now, the price is just over $3 a gallon, and that's going to be very difficult to bear. In fact, if you tote up the cost, it's pretty much the size of the tax rebate.
$4 for a gallon of gasoline, that is chilling.
It is chilling. So, we need to really work hard to try to solve this problem in the housing and mortgage markets to get the securities market rolling again, get credit flowing into the housing market. We need to do it quickly.
Mark Zandi, Chief Economist for MoodysEconomy.com, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
The skyrocketing rate of foreclosures that we just mentioned is creating more collateral damage. Tenants, they're paying their rent, but their landlords can't pay their mortgages. RealtyTrack estimates that rental properties make up 1 in 5 foreclosures. And in some cities like San Diego and Las Vegas, that figure jumps to nearly 50%. So what happens to the tenants when banks foreclose? Joining us first is Inel Mendez. She lives in the Boston neighborhood of Roxbury, where she rents a condo for $1,600 a month. But the property is facing foreclosure. And Inel, as part of the story, I actually visited your home, and it's a beautiful 3-bedroom condo. The kitchen has granite countertops, stainless steel appliances. But right now, you're afraid of eviction. Tell us about that.
All I know, I moved there be a year this coming April. Moved there on the 1st. And later on, after I moved into the complex, I found out that it's supposed to be on the foreclosure. No one has spoken to me yet about the property, but I was paying my rent to a young man. He used to come and pick it up.
And did that young man stop coming to pick up the check?
He haven't been back.
So nobody's come after you for the
nobody
rent?
Nobody come after me yet. But I also put the rent aside. And if anyone come after me, I will have their rent for them.
And are you looking for somewhere else to live?
At this present time, yes. I wish that I could own my own. But at this present time, the way the mortgage and the high prices of property is kind of hard, you know. And some people working 2 or 3 jobs just to pay rent. Something wrong with that. It's a big problem. It's not just happening here in Roxbury and all those. It's happening all over. It's nationwide now. And it's about time for the government, somebody to step in to see can they help people. Nobody want to be left out in the cold. Everybody needs somewhere to stay. And too many homeless people are out here right now with nowhere to stay. And this is America. What have happened to America? I would love to know. We're living in the 21st century, and people still worried about where they're going to live, what they're going to eat. That's a big problem. I thought after I left Alabama, I thought I would never have a problem. When I grew up in a shack, but I was happy even living in a shack. Everybody want to move beyond where they used to be and come up here. Everybody want their American dream.
I know. What's your biggest fear now?
I really don't fear anything because God didn't give me the heart of fear. He gave me a sound mind. And whatever going to be, it going to be. But I have faith.
Inel Mendez lives in a rental property in the Boston area that's facing foreclosure, and she could be facing eviction. Thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us.
You're quite welcome.
We now turn to Steve Meacham of City Life Vita Urbana, a tenant advocacy group in Boston. And Steve, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us.
And first, I just want to suss out, how is it that Inel Mendez doesn't know who owns the property that she's renting?
Well, you know, it's fairly typical for tenants to be in this situation where they're sailing along paying the rent, and the first time that they hear about the foreclosure is when they get a notice from the bank that says, we own the property now, you have to get out. But even once you get that notice from the bank, it's not at all clear which bank owns it, because there's one bank that's the trustee, there's one bank that's the servicer, there's the mortgage broker, you know, there's the lawyers for all these people, there's another lawyer for the investors. It can get very, very complicated. And the bank is not, in a sense, anxious to pursue you because they don't want your rent.
So as Inel said, she's not paying rent. She's setting it aside. She'd like to pay it. But you're saying banks don't even want it. Why? Because they don't want to be property managers.
They don't want to be property managers. But I think even more probably there's something that, because in some cases there are residents of buildings offering the banks the full appraised value of the building and they're turning it down.
Wow, that seems... doesn't make any sense.
Well, the mortgage value is much higher than the appraised value in many of the buildings in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan neighborhoods of Boston. So I think what they want to do is sit on vacant property until it comes up to a level that they think they can sell it at or near their mortgage value. And ironically, they're kind of shooting themselves and all the rest of us in the foot because the increasing number of vacant properties is dragging down the whole neighborhoods.
And how common is Inell's situation, a renter in a building that's being foreclosed on and being confused about if it's happening, when it's happening, who owns the property?
Well, I think it's very common. I mean, half the foreclosures in the city of Boston are probably rental properties, absentee-owned. And even in many of the other properties where the owner lives there, there are also tenants who are being affected. So maybe 60 to 70% of the people being evicted after foreclosure are tenants.
And your organization has organized something called eviction blockades. Can you explain what that is?
Well, we've been fairly successful in getting people legal help to stop the evictions or slow them down. But when that fails, we say, well, look, we're going to come out and sit in your doorway and try to prevent, you know, face down the bank and everything and try to prevent them from coming. We've done that a number of times already, and so far successfully. There are two households, a brother and a sister, who are blind, facing eviction by the Deutsche Bank. And again, their family member has offered the full appraised value to the bank. They've turned it down and insist on eviction. That's almost a caricature of what you think is happening. So we need new legislation, but the banks are really counting on evicting 1,500 to 2,000 families in Boston alone in 2008. It's a fantastically high number. They're counting on doing that easily. And even if people just assert their basic legal rights, which aren't many, but if they assert their basic legal rights, they can slow that down enough that the banks will reconsider, we believe.
What are the tenants' rights? I mean, many people have put down security deposits, first and last month rent. What rights do they have?
Well, they do lose a lot. Tenants lose their security deposits upon foreclosure, for example. But the banks do have to follow certain procedures. They have to take people to court. You know, when you go to court, you can file, you know, motions, and, you know, a tenant can say that a bank is required to fix up the place before they can evict them, no fault. I guess I'd want to emphasize that most of the tenants' rights in this situation come from the fact that banks are evicting all these people no fault. They haven't done anything wrong, and the evictions are formally no-fault evictions. And so we are saying to the banks simply, you should have a reason to evict somebody. You shouldn't be able to evict these thousands of people no fault.
Well, banks argue they're not in the business to manage property, and when the foreclosures happen, it's not like, as you said, a single bank owns the mortgage because of the way that the loans are bundled and sold as securities, so it's just easier to sell. Doesn't a bank have the right to protect its own interests?
Well, they do, for certain, but after all, the financial industry has constructed this bizarre setup. You know, when we met with representatives of the Deutsche Bank, they were saying to us that, explaining the difference between 20 years ago when you used to go down to your corner bank and get a loan and then 10 years later they were still there, and it's different now. Well, that is true, it's different. But the financial industry has set that thing up, and they set it up to be deliberately opaque. And they have basically led our country in some ways into a recession, probably. And I think it's the least that we can ask them to do is not to evict so many thousands of people and to disrupt all the communities and neighborhoods that are going to result from that. That's just an unconscionable thing to do.
Steve Meacham is the tenant organizing coordinator for City Life Vita Urbana, a tenant advocacy group in Boston. Thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you for having us.
Just ahead, we speak to a national expert who explains how renters across the country are being affected by the mortgage crisis. And later in the show, why are the bats of the Northeast dying? Here and now. Today we're talking about the impact of the home mortgage crisis on renters who are finding themselves facing eviction after banks foreclose on their landlords. Joining us with more is Nick Retsinas, director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be with you.
And Professor Retsinas, we just heard what's happening to tenants when banks foreclose on properties and renters are kicked out. Can you help put this all in context for us? First of all, how big of a problem is this?
This is probably the most significant housing problem, the larger issue of the subprime debacle and the wave of foreclosures that the government has seen certainly in the last 20 years. It is leaving a large wake, and in that wake are renters. We have often thought of this problem as a problem for homeowners struggling with subprime mortgages, but as your interviews point out, renters are also affected, really even beyond the individuals, because these foreclosures, the walking away from properties also have externalities. That is to say, neighborhoods and indeed cities as a whole are dramatically affected.
Can you explain how the rental market got in this quandary where tenants who are paying their rent are still being forced from their homes?
Well, many renters and most renters were playing by the rules and paying their monthly rent. But what happened as we started to see defaults in loans, owners at some point walked away, and at some point the properties were foreclosed upon by lenders. Lenders who are supposed to act on behalf of the investors who hold the mortgage. But lenders really don't have a lot of experience dealing with foreclosed properties. We had almost a decade of unprecedented housing prosperity. So they were pretty good at collecting money from owners of the property. They're not so good as being landlords, and they're really not eager to have that role.
So does that explain why, as we heard from our guest, Inel Mendez, that no one is collecting her rent?
Well, there's no excuse for that. I mean, there is a liability for the property and for making sure that the property is maintained, and part of that is collecting the rent that can go into maintenance. But these can be very complex transactions. And again, without an experience in this kind of market environment, we find that the servicers really aren't able to take on this responsibility. Their eagerness is to quickly sort of foreclose and sell off the property as quickly as possible. Being a landlord is not in their job description.
In some areas, there are protections for tenants. For example, in Oakland, California, it's illegal to evict a tenant because of foreclosure. But Reuters reports that in one case in that city, the landlord of a building raised all rents from about $800 a month to $10,000 a month as a way to force the tenants out. So in general, what sort of legal protections are there for tenants?
Limited. Many tenants are on a month-to-month. And with the foreclosure or the abandonment of the property, again, there's really no one in charge, and there are no sort of protections. So while in the short term, you know, a tenant might not have to sort of pay the rent because there's nobody collecting, eventually that's going to lead to deferred maintenance, of lack of investment in the property. Tenants certainly enhance their position when they have long-term leases, but long-term leases can be dangerous in a building where you see deterioration of the property.
So who's looking out for the tenants? I mean, the president has announced two plans with banks to help borrowers avoid foreclosure, but is the federal government planning to do anything to help tenants?
Well, with all due respect to the intent of the federal government, I think it's fair to say the federal government has really underreacted to the gravity of the problem. What they propose so far are voluntary arrangements between sort of people who are on the verge of sort of keeping up with their payments, who need a little bit of a tweak. It doesn't speak at all to the issues of people who end up in this sort of turbulence being cast aside. Now, there are some proposals being put forward in the Congress for a housing stimulus package that would do things like provide funds for nonprofits to buy some of these foreclosed properties and try to ensure that they remain affordable to working families. Now, it's hard to say how far that will go because so far the administration has resisted that kind of intervention.
Well, what should tenants do if their building is foreclosed? Should they stay put and stage eviction blockades like we heard about in Boston? Or what advice would you give them?
Well, I'm not sure I would give sort of advice for eviction blockades, but certainly they should explore their options. They should keep paying their rent, assuming there's someone to collect the rent, but they all should be looking at other options. It is a difficult time in the market, and the market will eventually correct, but it'll certainly be a period of time. So I'd say it's look at other alternatives, try to make sure you honor your part of the agreement in terms of paying the rent, with the caveat that even that might not suffice.
So they don't have a lot of options, it sounds like. Then how do you see this crisis ending for tenants?
Very difficult. It's going to be a very sort of difficult time, again, not only for the tenants and the owners, but the neighborhoods overall. At some point, we will work through this. Markets do correct. The problem is they correct sometimes without feeling for the people affected. So it's going to be a difficult time. Ironically, some of their other options are going to be limited too, because you're likely to see some examples of rents going up, because people who had the opportunity in past years to become homeowners now will not have that opportunity with the chokehold on credit that exists, and that's going to add to rental demand. So they're probably going to be looking at increasing rental figures.
Not a bright picture, I'd have to say.
Not a very bright picture at all.
Well, Nick Retsinas, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nick Retsinas is director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. He spoke with us about how the mortgage crisis is forcing renters from their homes. While the prospects are bleak for tenants caught up in the home mortgage crisis, Congress is trying to prevent more fallout. Lawmakers are considering several proposals, which include easing bankruptcy rules, shielding banks from lawsuits, and providing government assistance to homeowners facing foreclosure. Lawmakers also plan to question several high-profile mortgage and banking executives about industry-wide losses and lavish executive compensation packages. Meanwhile, housing figures out today show that home prices took the largest hit in 20 years last quarter, dropping nearly 9% nationwide, and much higher in several cities that had been experiencing housing booms. The worst hit areas were Miami, where housing prices dropped 17.5%, and Las Vegas and Phoenix, where prices plummeted by 15%. You're listening to Here and Now. Tonight, Democratic candidates Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama will hold their last debate before next week's primaries. A New York Times poll out today shows Obama surging ahead of Clinton. And today, Senator Chris Dodd endorsed Obama from Ohio, a state in which Clinton, up until now, held a steady lead. It's shaped up to be a crucial primary. Are election machines ready to handle the votes? About one-third of all voters will cast their votes on touchscreen voting machines during this primary season. States and counties across the U.S. turned to these machines for a more accurate vote tally after the confusion with hanging chads in Florida in the 2000 presidential election. The problem is many places have found these new computerized voting machines more difficult to work with. And states like California and Florida have renounced them, and Ohio is switching from digital back to paper. We're looking closely at Ohio, where the Secretary of State asked Cuyahoga County to make the switch before next week's primary. With us is Jane Platten, director of the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections in Ohio. Jane, we appreciate you making time for us. You must be very busy.
Thank you. It has been a very busy last 62 days.
And that's
When we were told to switch voting systems.
So why were you asked to make the switch?
The Secretary of State in Ohio conducted a study of all voting systems in the state, and she realized that the Diebold system for Cuyahoga was not one that was working for us. We had system crashes throughout a lot of elections last year, particularly in November 2007. And on December 21st, there was a mandate by the Secretary of State that we switch, so we had then 62 days before the primary to implement the optical scan paper ballot system in Cuyahoga County.
Tell us about what happened in the November 2007 elections with the new machines.
The election day and election management went well throughout the day, but as soon as we started uploading results, we were at the 300th memory card out of 6,000 to be uploaded. When we put the 300th card in, the system crashed. So when you're standing in front of a server that's tabulating your election results on election night, and you're dependent upon that system, and it crashes, and the screen goes blank, that's when my knees got weak. That's when I had to turn to my board members and Assistant Secretary of State, who was in the agency, and throw my arms up and say, I don't know if we're going to be able to tabulate results tonight. That is not a good position for an election administrator to be in on election day.
I can imagine. Can you give us a bit of the background? Cuyahoga County was one of the many places that bought touchscreen voting machines to solve problems, but you found that touchscreens brought new problems. Can you tell us about some of those?
Cuyahoga County turned to the touchscreen system for the May 2006 primary election, and in that election, our optical scan ballots were unable to be read by the scanners. For a variety of reasons, 18,000 optical scan ballots hand-read, hand-counted later, multiple other issues with the system. Throughout the next two-year period, we had problems with servers crashing. Cuyahoga County is a very large, complex county, and the system just did not have the capacity to withstand our needs.
You had instituted a lot of new things to make sure these machines worked well, and that poll workers, many of whom are elderly, knew how to operate them and had technical assistance.
Yes, we had totally revamped our entire poll worker training. We had implemented safeguards basically against the complexity of the system, so that our poll workers and our voters and my staff understood it better. So we were making strides in the year 2007 in terms of handling the system, but the server crash was the final straw.
And I read, too, that it had a stunning error rate of about one audit found that about 72% of audited machines, the paper trail did not match the digital tally.
Right. That was a study that was done in 2006. And the other issue with the paper trail is when those devices were originally manufactured, they did not have the voter verified paper audit trail attached.
What is the verified voter paper trail?
In Ohio, they passed a law saying that on electronic voting devices, you must have a paper trail. And it is very literally like a cashier's receipt underneath a piece of glass. The voter looks at it, verifies that they've chosen the right candidates according to their desire, and then they hit the cast ballot button on the touch screen. So it quite literally mirrors what you voted on the touch screen and verifies that your choices were taken correctly by the device. That's the official ballot in Cuyahoga County in the state of Ohio, according to law. They had to retrofit those paper receipt canisters onto the device. It was very difficult for the poll workers to manipulate those or to operate the paper trail. And when we went to do recounts, oftentimes those paper trails were severely damaged and unreadable.
But in the end, with all these problems you faced with these, and with all of your experience in this field, do you think that the touchscreen voting machines should be scrapped?
I am comfortable with going with a paper ballot system, and especially now that we're 62 days into a transition, and we're 7 days today away from a primary election. I can't scratch my head and say, paper, touchscreen, should we not? I have to just move and operate an election in a paper ballot system.
And how much is this transition costing? I mean, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act in 2002 that gave some money incentive for people to switch actually to electronic voting systems. How is Ohio paying for this?
Well, the Cuyahoga County commissioners are dipping into the general fund to pay for this election above and beyond what we had already budgeted. And we are actually renting the system for the March primary, and then decisions will be made about purchases and permanent voting systems after this primary election. We have a contract with ES&S, which is the vendor, for $1.4 million for this election. Now, that includes the system as well as ballots.
So $1.4 million just to rent the system. And if you were to buy it, how much would that cost?
We're probably looking at an additional $9 to $10 million based on the fact that we would have to buy precinct-based optical scanners. Right now, we're going to run the election on what's called a central count optical scan, where all the ballots will be brought down to the Board of Elections building in downtown Cleveland and counted. But in the future, we need to move towards a more precinct-based system so that there is second-chance voting options.
Have you experienced problems, this isn't to do with voting machines, but registered voter rolls?
You know, not so far. In 2004, Cuyahoga County had some serious issues with registration rolls and voters going into the polling locations and not being in the poll books. We've been working hard to try and clean up those registration. But at this point, that will probably come more in November. There will be huge registration drives in the middle of the summer, and we'll get tens of thousands of new registrants, but for the primary, that's not taking place yet.
Jane Platten, Director of the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections in Ohio, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives. And you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. The bat population in New England is facing a serious threat, a contagious and deadly sickness that's been dubbed white nose syndrome. It's spreading through New York, Vermont, and now Massachusetts, leaving thousands of bats dead and scientists puzzled. Beth Daly is an environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. She's been covering the bat sickness, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How big is this problem, Beth?
It's pretty big right now, and it's spreading. It was first discovered in New York last January, and at that point, scientists didn't know what was happening. They had gone to a couple of bat caves and found bats that had this mysterious white fungus on their nose, and that was basically the only sign they were ill. But by March, there were dead bats littering the floor of that cave and four others. And about 11,000 bats in New York died last year. This year, the situation is much, much worse. There are about 13 caves in New York infected, two mines in Massachusetts. There are two caves in Vermont that are infected, and scientists believe that many, many more will be very soon throughout the Northeast.
So thousands of sick and dead bats last winter, thousands more expected this year. Do scientists have any clue what's causing this?
They don't, and that's what's so scary. They predict there's going to be hundreds of thousands of bats dead by March, based on last year's evidence, because once they start discovering these bats with the white nose, and some of them, not all of them have it, but most of them do, the mortality rate is extraordinarily high, as much as 97% in some caves.
Well, what other symptoms are being reported besides this white nose?
In addition to the white nose, they'll start flying around in the middle of the hibernating season. They'll go outside in broad daylight. Bats don't like daylight in general, but particularly in the winter. They are crashing into snowbanks. They're just freezing solid on the sides of homes. And all the bats they find have no fat left in them. So they think there's some theories that they're starving to death. There's also some evidence that they may be suffering from a pneumonia-like illness. But scientists just don't know. They don't know if the bats got ill before they went into hibernation, if some sort of pathogen was tracked in by humans, if there's some disease taking hold of them. They just have no idea.
And the disease has spread throughout four bat species so far, including the federally endangered Indiana bat. And on top of that, bats only give birth to maybe one pup a year. So what are the chances that the bat populations will rebound after such a huge loss?
It's very, very small. And that's why bat experts, we have some of the best bat experts right in our backyard in New England. And they are actually saying things like, we could lose the entire bat populations, not only the federally endangered Indiana bat, but all these other bats that we see every day that you may not know the names of.
What does this all matter, though, for people who maybe don't like bats in the first place?
I know. It's funny. I got a couple of notes saying, I don't like bats. They come in my house and I have to, you know, call the exterminator. But two things. One, bats really do eat a lot of pests. In other parts of the world, they pollinate plants and they disperse seeds. That does not occur in New England. But they just eat lots and lots of bugs, millions. Likely.
And mosquitoes.
And mosquitoes, the things that we don't like. And then more broadly, scientists feel like they probably fill some sort of ecological niche we're not even aware of right now. What that is, they don't know. And just like losing any sort of the polar bear, you just don't want to lose it because it was here when we started. We want to keep those species here.
So this illness sounds similar to what the bees are also facing in this country, something called colony collapse disorder, an unknown illness striking thousands and thousands of bees who are also important pollinators.
Yeah, a lot of scientists see a very, very clear similarities between the two because they're both just incredible ecological mysteries. You have thousands, if not millions, of dead bees in the colony disorder case. But in the bat case, it's bats. And they just don't know where to start. They don't know, is it a virus? Is it a pathogen? Is it pesticides? We just don't know. They don't know.
So what are they doing to try to find the cause?
Well, it's actually fascinating. There's probably about 60 researchers around the country working in labs on it, about 15 labs, federal labs, government labs, university labs, and private labs trying to identify what this illness is. At the same time, there's an army of researchers going into virtually every cave and mine where bats are hibernating in the Northeast, as well as in Florida and other parts of the country, to determine how many caves or mines are infected with this disease.
So they're working on it.
They're working on it very, very hard, and they're very, very scared.
Beth Daly, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Beth Daly is an environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. We're listening listening to the first movement of Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, entitled From the New World. It's one of the works that the New York Philharmonic played today in Pyongyang, North Korea, along with the national anthems of both countries. It's the first time that an American orchestra has ever performed in the country President Bush has called a member of the Axis of Evil. It's a diplomatic effort of sorts into a closed society. Yesterday, we spoke to Alex Redding, professor of music at Harvard University, about the visit and the music the Philharmonic chose to play. First, why did North Korea invite the New York Philharmonic?
The New York Phil is one of the five big orchestras in America. It's worldwide renowned. So it makes a lot of sense to ask the New York Philharmonic Orchestra.
And the Christian Science Monitor was calling this visit sing-song diplomacy, sort of a play on the ping-pong diplomacy, to signify a slight opening to the West from North Korea through music, as it did years ago through ping-pong in China.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of orchestral visits that played a big part in diplomacy. The two visits that are important and that could be seen as parallels to this one are the Philadelphia Orchestra that visited China in 1973. The other example that springs to mind would be the Boston Symphony Orchestra that visited the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War in 1956, and that also had a relatively big impact on the cultural level.
So let's turn to the music that the New York Philharmonic has chosen to play. We're hearing a little more from the symphony that From the New World. This is from the fourth movement. Tell us a little bit more about this piece and what we're hearing.
It was first written in 1893 when Dvorak was visiting in America, and it was actually written for the New York Phil. He was inspired, let's say, by music that he'd heard on his trip in America, and some people have said that the American tunes that we hear really sound a lot like the Bohemian tunes that Dvorak used in his other compositions.
Dvorak is just one of the pieces they'll be playing. Another is George Gershwin's An American in Paris. What do these two selections say to the people of North Korea?
Well, these two pieces are very much chosen in the sense of this is American music, and the two pieces are really showpieces for the New York Philharmonic. They've often performed the Gershwin abroad. It's called An American in Paris, and so the theme of bringing American culture abroad is very much on the forefront of this particular piece, and it's full of jazz-inspired tunes. We have a very lively rhythm section. We hear car horns, so it's really the bustle of the city in a very American way.
So the first two pieces we've played have a very American feel, as you say, and their selection for a North Korean audience seems pretty straightforward. But the Philharmonic is also playing the prelude to Act 3 of Richard Wagner's Lohengrin. What do you think about their choice to play this piece?
You know, that's a really interesting choice to make because, as you say, it's so different from the other pieces. It's safe to say that it was chosen because it's a piece of brilliant orchestral writing. It is the kind of repertoire that the New York Philharmonic play very well. And in many ways, it's also a slightly more ambiguous choice in terms of what the pieces might mean. The choice of Wagner is never neutral.
Because he has associations with Hitler?
Well, that's absolutely right. You could say that this isn't exactly Wagner's fault because he was dead by the time Hitler came to power, but there certainly are lots of pretty nasty pieces of political views in Wagner's thinking, and he didn't hold them back. So we know that he was a pretty rabid anti-Semite in the 19th century, and his music has been put to political use in the 20th century, especially under the Hitler regime. We'll be right back.
Tell us more about Wagner's opera.
Well, if we look at the way the overture is incorporated in the whole opera, it comes at a really odd moment. It's the beginning of Act 3, and what we hear is effectively wedding music. The music is very joyful and bubbly, and it sort of tries to represent the bustle of the wedding preparation. And in fact, the piece of music that comes immediately after the overture is the famous wedding march, Here Comes the Bride. However, in the course of this act, the wedding goes horribly wrong. So in that sense, I think it could be seen as a sensitive choice for this kind of diplomatic occasion, because it is a kind of wedding advance of sorts. And if we try to read along, it seems like the music is suggesting that there might be a bad awakening. I don't think we should overinterpret it that way, but in a way, that's the beauty of music. It seems to say so many things, and it can mean so many things, but it never says anything specific. And so it's up to us to interpret it. And of course, there's always the danger of overinterpretation.
Well, in a Wall Street Journal commentary last week, the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, Lauren Mazel, said arts have a broader role to play in the public arena, but it must be totally apolitical, nonpartisan, and free of issue-specific agendas. Do you think his music choice has played into this?
I think what he is saying is that he's trying to hold the kind of interpretations and speculations that might run wild, especially with this piece. He's trying to hold them under control by saying, it's just music, you know, let's just listen to it. Let's not worry too much about the interpretation of it. Let's just enjoy it for the sounds, for the music that it is.
Instead of, say, doing an entirely American program with Leonard Bernstein, Philip Glass.
Right. Yes, I think so. We have this idea of music as the universal language. Nowadays, we tend to think that it's not quite universal, but it's certainly transnational. And perhaps one of the interesting things that's worth considering here is that the New York Philharmonic was very adamant that this program should be broadcast on the radio so that everybody in North Korea can listen to this concert.
Well, do you believe that music is powerful enough to act as a means of diplomacy, as at least the New York Philharmonic is trying to put forward to some sense by saying all North Koreans should have the opportunity to hear this music?
Yes, I think so. Obviously, it's difficult to say, but I think they certainly have a very good stab at it.
We've been speaking with Alex Redding, professor of music at Harvard University, about the New York Philharmonic's historic visit to North Korea. Alex, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, it's been a pleasure.
The New York Philharmonic concert is scheduled to air Thursday on PBS stations around the country. For more information, please go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again, Here and Now.